Hello and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things investors need to know for the week ahead. Now, we're a day late this week. That's because we wanted to include some very important UK data. So, Alan, I'm sure this is going to be one of the things you're going to be talking about, but what are the things we need to know this week?
So, morning, Sarah. So, as usual, we'll have a look at the data, including hot off the press UK CPI and a little bit in China. Then, a bit of a deeper dive into China, what's happening there. And people shouldn't turn off when I say this, a little bit of sort of index investing. One, there's a rebalance on the NASDAQ because these tech stocks, the Magnificent Seven, are getting bigger and bigger. But an interesting story about Vanguard and a bit of a book recommendation. And what does Vanguard have to do with a heavy metal band? Well, we'll come to that.
I'm very curious to know what that's all about. And also very interested to get your thoughts on this whole passive versus active debate, because I know it's a debate that's been going on for quite some time now. OK, well, let's kick off then with data. I think before we get to the UK data, do we want to just very quickly reflect back on the US CPI? That came out last week, didn't it, after we recorded last week's episode?
Yeah, so good news is that US inflation has fallen all the way from 9 to 3, nice round numbers. But what's getting people really excited is stuff like the median CPI. There's all kinds of data in the States, and the median CPI will be that item in the basket, which is the median. And there's even some things like the trimmed mean, which means you take out the biggest faller and the biggest riser. And that's right, 2%, for example. So basically, when economists look at the underlying data, and especially the core services part of it, getting quite excited because services is obviously harder to break. Whereas if you like, petrol prices, energy prices, food prices falls straight through. So it looks like it's working in the States and inflation is falling.
So that 3% figure, that's the headline figure, isn't it? Because what did core come in at?
Core came in at still circa 5%, but it was really because the way inflation is calculated, that's year over year. So that's 12 months of data.
Yeah.
What people are getting excited about is looking at the 1 month data. It's the 1 month data that people are getting excited. Analyzing 1 month is a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
But there's widespread data there which shows US inflation really is falling. So for big falls in core, that's going to take some time for numbers to drop out, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I presume because rent's a big factor, isn't it, in core inflation in the US, and that's got to come down, hasn't it?
That's got to come down. And the way they calculate, we talked about this before, the way they calculate rent in the US is fairly esoteric. It's not direct rent payments. They call it imputed, which is basically imagine what your house or flat would rent for, and they come up with a number for that, and it tends to be lagging. But the big picture is that US is ahead of the curve and of course, good progress.
Okay. Well, you say good progress. Now, I haven't had a chance to catch this yet, but this is hot off the press. We're making a little bit of progress in the UK, aren't we, as well?
Yeah, I'm stunned. Data in the UK has come in much better than expected.
Fantastic.
How did that happen? So, nowhere near as good as the US, but basically UK inflation fell to 7.9. Everyone will know that now. And so the main piece of information there is better than expected. And even core, you mentioned core about the States, which has got a kind of five handle. We're up at 6.9. So still a bit of a disappointing performance, but the important point, better than expected. And the markets are loving it. And there's a bit of love for the UK coming through today. So, for example, the FTSE's up over 1%, but the FTSE 250, which has more UK-orientated companies, is up 2.5%. And relief for those with mortgages, big rally in bonds. And, of course, bonds, especially two-year and five-year bonds, you can think of two-year and five-year bonds basically being two-year and five-year fixed mortgages, fallen about 0.25% 2 years. Pretty much the same in 5 years. So 2-year gilts down to 4.8%. So basically the market's thinking, good news on inflation. Maybe the Bank of England doesn't have to be so aggressive on interest rates.
Okay. Well, I mean, England is getting better. It's still potentially possibly one of the worst, but is there somewhere doing worse than the UK at the moment as far as inflation is concerned?
Yeah, the land of where the Beyoncé inflation,
it wasn't the Beyoncé blip then. It was something a bit more longer term, was it?
Well, or you know, everyone has theories about these things. So Swedish inflation stuck at 9.3%.
Right.
So it was higher than the UK before. And we mentioned previously some economists, Danske Bank in particular, blamed it on the Beyoncé effect, in the sense that hotels, restaurants, you know, they try to make a bit of money, can't blame them, the start of the tour. But it doesn't seem to be fading. Just like Beyoncé's, charm and the way she's revered around the world, including my daughter, it doesn't seem to be fading in Sweden. But we'll keep an eye out. I've got two sources, one at Morgan Stanley, one at Columbia Threadneedle, very good Swedish tennis players and financiers, and they blame it on currency weakness. So, we'll always reference Sweden while it's doing so badly.
Yes, good to have somewhere to look at that's doing worse than us. Actually, you mentioned tennis, and that reminds me, I haven't asked you about Wimbledon, because we did talk on a recent episode about Wimbledon debentures, and we were talking about the price that people pay, talking about inflation, the price that people pay for a men's final ticket. What were they selling for in the end? So we had a Djokovic, Alcaraz, who you tipped, I think, a couple of episodes ago as one to watch. How are tickets going for the final for the men's?
It's great that I'm better at tennis theory than investment theory. Thank you for that, because I'm about to talk about China and how I got it completely wrong. What an amazing final, by the way. I know you're not such a super fan, but it was amazing. Takes me back to 2008 when Federer played Nadal, and it went on and on and on. Amazing final. So the tickets were about £10,000. And only debenture holders can secure that price. So we will need to come back, Sarah, and check if the Alcaraz effect has any impact on the prices of debentures.
Yeah.
Also, I did get someone message me and said, really loved our podcast on debentures. It wasn't just about debentures. And they asked me, could I look at Lord's debentures, Twickenham debentures, please? So I have to do a bit of research. I'm aware of these debentures. I'm not aware about their secondary market trading, but we will do that. Be a nice thing to do in the summer. We'll come back and look a bit more wider. But yes, amazing. And we'll come back on where Wimbledon debentures are trading and see if Alcaraz has given a lift to prices.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Djokovic got himself in a little bit of trouble as well, didn't he? Did he get a fine or something for abusing his racket or something?
Yeah. He smashed his racket. If you didn't see it, I think he was fined about £6,000. But don't worry, he took home 1.17 million as a loser. But he really smashed his racket badly, and very bad. And also he hurt his wrist doing so. He smashed it against the post. So if you're going to smash a racket, don't smash it against something at the post. Don't smash a racket in general, because his wrist was not right and kind of contributed to that. But I have to say, super gracious in defeat, Djokovic. Absolutely charming and gracious and lovely to see. But anyway, this will become a sporting podcast if we're not careful.
Okay, well, let's get you back on track then. Before we come to sort of the Chinese economy in a bit more depth, I mean, we've had Chinese data out. Their GDP is losing momentum, isn't it? It's not great.
Yeah, so the data, cover the data first. So the a whole range of data came out, but basically GDP disappointed. It may not look that disappointing at 6.3% year over year, but one, China, like a lot of emerging markets, is a faster growing economy. Two, I mentioned where I've got things wrong, because I looked at the post-COVID bounce we had in Europe and the US, and you may remember, I said, well, there'll be a V-shaped recovery post-COVID. And a bit of credit, one thing, why? Because there's always a V-shaped recovery. There always has been. There was a huge V-shaped recovery. We all experienced it. And I really thought China would have an extreme V-shaped recovery because of their love of consumption. And it hasn't happened. Retail sales, which normally have been growing, I say normally, have been growing for many years now at 10 to 13%, is only up 3% year on year. So there is something really wrong with China. The data is really weak, and especially really weak when there should be a post-COVID rebound.
Okay. Well, let's just before we move on then to the Chinese economy then in more detail, just to sort of summarise then that the data, sort of key data we've got. So US inflation that came out last week, that headline figure is 3%, which is pretty good, and we're getting closer to that sort of magic number of 2%. Good news about the UK. The headline inflation fell and it's down to 7.9%, which is fantastic. Core still quite sticky at 6.9%. But there is a country that's doing worse for us, worse than us, and that's Sweden. And it's got not much to do with Beyonce by the looks of things. It's got perhaps partly to do with a weak currency. And then we've got Chinese data that's quite disappointing at the moment. Retail sales are fairly weak and their GDP is, their growth is fairly sort of slow. But let's talk about the Chinese economy in a little bit more detail then. What's going on in there? Why did they not get that post-COVID bounce that we saw in Europe and in the US?
So Sarah, as I've said before many times on this podcast, warning, here comes some theories, because no one knows for sure, because we don't know the counterfactual. But some theories out there, the importance of property to yes. the Chinese consumer and the fact that property is in a bear market and there's not many alternative outlets for Chinese individuals, especially in terms of excess cash. And we've got a society that buys an extra property but not even to rent out. We've got this culture of actually leaving them empty as a easy way to make money. And it was an easy way to make money. And that stopped now, and the music stopped. So, and of course, many property companies have gone bankrupt, on the verge of going bankrupt. And the financing, which came from typically local government, that's fading away, and therefore, demand is really weak, and they've got this chronic problem of unemployment. Youth unemployment is 20%.
Yeah,
even graduates at pretty good universities are struggling to get good roles. So a bit of a problem there, and it goes to show again theory. It's how hard it is to plan an economy. It really is. And I can think of only one successful planned capitalist economy, and that's Singapore. And that's a model that people have said, well, you know, if it works in Singapore, could it work in China? It seems harder to get it to work in China, but fairly depressing. I mean, look, on the flip side, it's still pretty fast growth, you know, 6%.
How much can we rely on those figures? I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions over the data coming out of China, but can we rely on when they set out publicly, you know, very high sort of expectations of growth, and they then often meet those expectations? Can we rely on those figures that are coming out of China?
I think you're right to be skeptical. There has been some evidence of smoothing. And there has been alternative data looked at, such as electricity consumption, railroad use, et cetera, like that, like real economy. But we've got something slightly different now. Now we've got, instead of cheerleading from the Chinese authorities, we've got Chinese authorities showing weak data, especially on
consumption. Okay.
So my judgment is that it's actually better than it used to be, Sarah, the data. And certainly, we saw, you know, really depressed numbers as we went through COVID, realistic numbers. So I think it has got better. It's a problem. And the other aspects, of course, has been the crackdown on many first previously fast growing sectors, technology and education in particular. And it's makes it pretty hard to do business and hire people, et cetera, and have a vibrant economy. Mm. Now, the good news is there's strong signs of easing up and relenting and even cheerleading the stock market. The weak stock market is now seen as a bit of a problem in China, and it is a very cheap market. So these things can turn very, very quickly, a bit like the UK is a very cheap market, as we know, but we have a cheap market without necessarily the growth. China has the cheap market with the growth. But I would say that the intervention makes it hard to work. Funnily enough, when I started my career, Japan used to try and intervene and control the economy. Famously, used to be called MITI, used to try and direct resources to various sectors. It's hard to make that work. Look, I'm open-minded, and Singapore amazingly seemed to have made it work in terms of a planned capitalist economy, but it's hard. So, yeah, a bit depressing news out of China, but that doesn't stop some, especially global companies, the likes of LVMH, which is covered by Coutts. Apple, of course, make huge money in China.
And we are seeing a little bit of a softening in the relationship between the US, aren't we? We had Janet Yellen was over there, was it last week or earlier this week? So potentially there's a little bit of rapprochement there between China and the US, which has got to be good, hasn't it?
That's a good point. That's the other aspect. That is right. But I would like to think, as our role as a shareholder and a fiduciary of earning returns for clients, is that the Chinese authorities will respect minority shareholders and debt holders a little more, and less intervention, frankly. You know, intervention where it's absolutely needed for regulatory reasons, of course. But some of the crackdowns have gone beyond that. In my view, the likes of Alibaba simply getting too big, or the leader being too controversial. And the crackdown on the education sector, you know, seems fairly severe. And the basic idea is that the authorities there didn't like the idea that companies are making a lot of money out of education. I get it that you want to provide it for everyone, but it's pretty hard to do that. As we know, sitting here in the UK or anywhere, it's pretty hard for the state to do everything.
So that's China. You know, we're still seeing some fairly sort of disappointing economic data coming out of China, particularly in the property market, which is so fundamental for the Chinese economy, and perhaps evidence that that sort of interventionist approach doesn't really work if you want to have a really successful global sort of capitalist economy. All right, then. Now, last but not least, for those of you still listening, I promise you this is going to be really interesting. We want to talk a little bit about index investing, but we're going to talk about the NASDAQ 100. They're doing a rebalancing. Explain to me why they're doing this, what this means, because I don't really quite get this. It's not something they do that often, is it? But they do it every now and then.
Yeah, so the NASDAQ, it's only 100 stocks. It's up 38% this year, led by the so-called Magnificent Seven. So it's been really, really strong. It has the likes of Microsoft, Apple, Tesla in there, et cetera. A rebalance. So we know from the UK, the FTSE 100 can be a bit concentrated in a different way in terms of oil majors and a few very large companies. Well, it's the same in the US. And put simply, the weighting of tech stocks to fall from 44% to 38%. So relatively modest, but kind of a step almost in the right direction, because where I've seen in my career index investing go wrong was actually Japan at the end of 1990. And I'll go into more detail another time, where everyone knows about the bear market in Japan. Less people know about how a disaster it was for index, being in the index. Basically, it's when you really wanted to be inactive. But I'll come back to that. But just generally on index investing, firstly, a book recommendation for the summer. To be fair, this book has been out for about a year. Trillions by the FT journalist Robert Wigglesworth. And it's a book about the rise of index investing, which we know has been very, very dominant, but very, very entertaining. And it features an interesting story about Vanguard, And there was a funny story about Vanguard in terms of, you know, pretty reasonably well known in the States now, but really less well known in Europe. And when they did market surveys, do you know what Vanguard does? One of the most common responses was, aren't they a heavy metal band? Because I love that, because it does sound like a heavy metal band, doesn't
That's
it?
A bit, yeah, it does a bit.
Just imagine it. Here's the latest hit from Vanguard, bashing out some Metallica type super heavy rock. Other people thought, is it a defense company? Vanguard?
Yeah.
Fair enough. But anyway, the story of Vanguard and how it split from Wellington Asset Management. Jack Bogle, basically, just very interesting how these companies are formed. He was eased out of Wellington after being Wellington's a very large US active manager. And he just started up Vanguard. And now, of course, it's one of the leading providers. So look,
he's quite charismatic, isn't he? Because aren't the fans of him called Bogleheads or something?
That's
I
right,
read somewhere.
Yeah, he is charismatic, and you know he's we invest just for clarity. We invest with BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Lyxor, many providers, DWS, many providers of index product. And it's worth reading this book. This book is gives you a good concept of. That, and he's a great journalist, that it, kind of the structure of markets as well. So it's quite an important book in that respect.
Okay.
And remind me, I must do some other financial books for the summer.
Yes, we need a reading list. We've got a couple already, haven't we? But we've got this one, we'll add to the list. But I mean, coming back to this sort of talk about sort of index investing, I mean, perhaps index investing is a better thing, because if you use the term passive, it sounds a little bit negative, doesn't it? It sounds a bit like you're just kind of, we'll just stick the money over there and we'll forget about it. But that's not really what index investing is it?
It's not quite right, because you have to be very, very careful. It's like this example of the NASDAQ 100, which is getting concentrated. You have to be really aware of what's happening here. And index passive, passive is a negative word, a negative marketing word. Look, we embrace it. We use it. We do use active managers, and our active managers are actually performing pretty well this year. We embrace it at Coutts, and there's cost reasons, but also there's the data. The data shows that active management, especially in the States, is really, really hard. I think I mentioned before, over 5 years, 80% of active managers underperform. It's a tough gig.
Why is that? Is that because of concentration, which we've got at the moment, or is that a kind of general rule? There's something about the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ that makes it difficult to be a stock picker.
Again, we've got some theory. No one knows for sure. To turn that around, where does active management do well? Going back to China, active managers in China, where there's a lot of retail investors. Whereas if you think about managing money in the States, less retail investors, a zero-sum game, super smart people competing with each other, and therefore costs start to become important and eat into returns, very hard to get right. But it is an intriguing aspect, and no one knows for sure, but there does seem to be a correlation between the degree of retail participation in a market versus how institutional it is.
Okay. On that note, I noticed that Robinhood are going to be launching in the UK, aren't they? Talking of retail investors.
Yeah, I did see that. But you know, there's so many cheap ways of getting exposure to the markets. But I'm not sure it's going to make that much of a difference. But let's see.
Just one final question then on this rebalancing of the NASDAQ. Does that mean that indexes that are holding the NASDAQ, is there going to be a little bit of churn going on within those funds, or is there going to be a bit of volatility as a result of this?
So, at the margin, these big Magnificent Seven stocks, or some of the Magnificent Seven stocks, will be sold. That will happen, but they're so large, and NASDAQ 100, it is followed as index, but it's not the main index that's followed in the States is the S&P 500. It's broader. So I actually think the impact will be fairly limited. But if I'm wrong, I'll be back up here to say this is another thing I've been wrong about.
Don't worry, I'm making a note. Oh, thank you very much, Anne. So just to summarise then, as far as the sort of index investing goes. We talked about the fact that we've got a book recommendation for you, which is Trillions by Robert Wigglesworth. He's an FT journalist, all about.
I think it's Robin.
Wigglesworth.
I said Robin, but it's Robin Wigglesworth. I haven't got the book in front of me. It's here somewhere.
Okay. So that's index investing. That sounds like a good read for the beach if you want to sort of keep up to speed with things. We talked about the fact that the NASDAQ 100 is rebalancing because of the dominance of the Magnificent Seven, but we sort of then broadened that out a little bit more into the sort of whole sort of concept of index investing and the fact that particularly in the US, where you have a lot of retail participation in the market, it's actually very difficult for active managers to sort of outperform indices, and actually passive investing or index investing, let's call it that because passive sounds a bit negative, actually does very, very well. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, you can subscribe to Need to Know via iTunes, Spotify or Google Podcasts. And you can also access previous episodes, including a recent one in which Alan and I looked at the rationale for investing in a higher interest rate environment. Some very interesting thoughts on at what point interest rates need to get to before they have a negative impact on equity investors. Now, we're actually going to let Alan go on holiday for a week, which seems remarkable. I think even 2 weeks, actually. So next week, I'm going to be joined by Coutts Head of Multi-Asset Portfolio Management, Monique Wong, who has been on Need to Know before, which is making a very welcome return. And she'll be back next week for Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.